Okay, so we talked a little bit about trying to understand the role of minhag, and it seems to be one of the first halachos that are told to us in the context of trying to figure out the Jewish ethical system. And let's try to get a little bit more exposure to how that plays out in the broader realm of Dinei Mamonos. And just before we turn to that, I just want to add one more point, just to spell out a little bit more clearly. We were talking yesterday about the question of the wall and what the wall is there for, and the conclusion of the Gemara that it's motivated by Hezek Re'iyah, but we noted yesterday that doesn't necessarily explain all the details or all the rules that don't seem to necessarily be necessary because of Hezek Re'iyah, and we looked at different perspectives about that. So I just wanted to expand for a moment on the position of Rav Shimon Shkop, which is interesting, and not everyone agreed with Rav Shimon Shkop. It's a discussion in the later Svarim. But just to explain a little bit more, it's a longer piece that he has in the beginning of the Shir Rav Shimon. Again, Rav Shimon is somebody we have additional fondness for, as he was a Rebbe here at YU for a short period of time, but he's most well known for his time in Telz, and he's most well known in the literary world for his two Sfarim. One is more on the block kind of Shiurim, so the Chiddush Rav Shimon Yehuda HaKohen. There's also a very wonderful sefer called Shaar Yosher. Shaar Yosher is a much more general lamdasha take on all of the difficult yesodos of halacha, which follows the format of the Sheiv Shmaisa, the Ksos HaChoshen. When he was young, he wrote a sefer where he talks about things like Edus and Sveikos and Chazakos and all of these foundational principles which pop up a lot in the world of Mamonos, but also in other areas of Torah as well. So Reb Shimon expounds on that in his Sefer Shaar Yosher. Rabbi Shechter's father-in-law, Rav Aaron Yeshaya Shapiro, was a Talmud of Reb Shimon. He was fundamental in bringing about the publication. He helped to prepare the writing of the Sefer. It's acknowledged in the Hakdama. The Hakdama is a very beautiful Hakdama, which addresses certain Hashkafic ideas, and very, very worth reading. So, just giving a little background in Rav Shimon Shkop. So, in the Shiurim on Bava Basra, so he develops the idea that when we talk about Mezikin that are liable, that you're chayiv for, so then we mean you are directly harming someone else. And in general, a Nezek is going to have to actually leave you and get to the other person. So some of the Gemaras later on above Bava Basra talk about smoke or things like that, or the roots of trees. So there is to have actual transfer from you to someone else that creates a hezek, even if the hezek is indirect. So that might be in the category of grama. You know, it might be something that's causational rather than the direct kind of hezekin that you're normally liable for, but at least it's that. But it says here, we're talking about something which is even less than that, the idea that you can see somebody from your property. So that's not even a grama the way he understood it. And he notes that if we were to see Hezek Re'iyah as a Nezek in that sense, and like we mentioned yesterday, we have to know how to translate the phrase Hezek Re'iyah Shmei Hezek. What does that mean? When there's two possibilities in the Gemara, Shmei Hezek or Lav Shmei Hezek. So we don't mean that it is actual Nezikin in the fullest sense, because it doesn't have all the consequences of Nezikin in the fullest sense. And by saying it's Shmei Hezek, we're saying, in modern language, the best way to translate is it's a thing, it's something significant, but it's not actual Nezikin in the fullest sense of the word. So how do we relate to that significance? We'll have to see more, but as Rav Shimon notes, that here it's not phrased as what you can and cannot do. It's phrased as what step are we going to take to make it less likely to happen. So let's say while you're waiting to build a wall, so do we have, are you not allowed to sit in your backyard while you're waiting for the wall to be built, because you will see your neighbor. So apparently we're not talking here about the hezek you're not allowed to do. We're talking here about a step that should be taken to prevent the likelihood of this thing, of this issue. So that's a part of his formulation, that this therefore should be taken as some kind of an additional step, maybe a chi of drabanam, to build a wall in order to make better neighbors. So that's just a little bit of a expansion on that point that we mentioned yesterday. Okay, so to continue the whole theme of minig and minig in Mamonos. So here, this is what's familiar to us, where we're coming from. But the notion of minig as a important force is something that is spread out throughout Shas, and in many iterations and in many contexts. And I gave you a few of them to look at this morning, but there's many more. And we also noted at the outset that presumably the different categories of minhagim, and that when we talk about minhagim in the area of ritual and the importance of minhag there, so that is because the minhagim that we observe are enhancements of a certain din or realizations of a certain halachic value. And even though the Torah itself didn't necessarily obligate that, and maybe even the rabbis didn't obligate it, but Klal Yisrael intuited that there is a certain value here, and therefore once they have set that pattern, it's appropriate to continue that pattern. And the Gemara associates that with the Pasuk, Shema b'ni musar avicha v'al titosh taras imacha, and mentioned the Nitziv, who understood that to be a mitzvah saseh midivrei Kabbalah, that the Nach is telling us there that there's a mitzvah to protect those minhagim. But presumably, that's different than the concept of minhag and mamon, although you do find overlapping terminology. So in the Bavli, we often have the phrase, which is already here in the Mishnah, of hakol k'minhag ha-medina, that everything is going to be dictated by the local custom. And often that's in the context of mamonos, but also in ritual context you find that as well. You find that same language for kol k'minhag ha-medina. And in the Yerushalmi, the language is more powerful, and there it appears twice, but it's in a stronger sense, ha-minhag, minhag mevatel halacha. Now, we have to figure out exactly what that means, that the idea that a minig can somehow overtake halacha, so clearly it must have a very specific meaning, because no one's going to say that Lashon Hara is mutter now, because that's the minig. That clearly there is parameters, there are parameters for what we mean when we say that minig can overtake halacha, not that that can rewrite the Torah. But apparently there are contexts in which the existence of a minig, so that becomes the guiding force, and that which is in halacha is not as authoritative as what the practice is. So in the context of mamonos, that's easier to relate to. The Rishalmi has it one place in Bav Metzia and one place in Yevamos, and Yevamos in the context of chalitza. So that's an interesting usage. But again, there it's not about rewriting the Torah, it's about establishing what is the best way to do chalitza. So in the context of mamonos, so that that's where we're coming from, and that we can relate to a little bit more, because we're saying in terms of establishing what are the rules, so minig mevatel halacha. So in that context, where it appears in the Bavli also, in the Mishnah, that you saw one of the most prominent cases of minig being dominant and being the guiding force within halacha is in the area of poelim. That's a very important area, that if somebody hires a worker who's a poel, so a poel is distinct from other designations, let's say an umen. So a poel, or let's say, is distinct from a koblin, for example. So a koblin just like it's used in modern Hebrew also, a kavod takes on a task. So, all right, so you decide to do a job, so then you have to do the job. But a poel is essentially hiring out his time, which is a tricky concept in halacha to begin with. So we have to figure out how exactly is that defined? How is a work day defined? What kind of work is expected? So it's in that context that the Mishnah has this notion of Hakol Kaminiga Medina, in many other contexts as well, but this is one of the dominant contexts, in the establishing the relationship between the employer and the employee. That, like we were saying, that there has to be a common set of expectations, that if somebody hires somebody else to show up for work, so what does that mean? What time does he have to show up? And what about his transportation expenses? And what kind of lunch break does he have? So all of these things have to be dictated by a system. And here the Gemara says, and Mishnah starts it off, that Hakol Kaminig HaMedina. So that's an important area. One of the major disputes that you have in contemporary halacha, one of the very, very controversial points, surrounds the application. This is not a small point at all. This is something which is litigated all the time in Bat Dei Din, just because this is where you have conflicts. So what were the expectations between a worker and the employer? So that's why, again, the more it's spelled out in advance, the better off you are. But one of the details that this entire svar is written about, and it's a very, very controversial issue that is constantly coming up again and again, that if a yeshiva lets go of a rebbe, so there is a whole question, just to illustrate an example, but there is a whole question of, in modern legal language, you call it severance pay. So if somebody is let go from a position, so sometimes they get a certain payment that is together with their leaving the position. So the severance, they're being severed from the job, but they get payment that goes along with that. And there's all kinds of rules that accompany that. It depends why they were leaving. If they're fired for cause, maybe it would be a different reason. If they're let go for budget reasons, that might be the other kind of consideration. If they retired, if they chose to retire, if they quit, if they were fired, all of that. So the details are all complicated when there is severance pay and when there isn't severance pay. But there is a notion in the yeshiva context of Chodesh Lashana. So Chodesh Lashana essentially means that you should be paid the salary of 1 month's pay for every year. So if somebody was working in a yeshiva for 25 years, so essentially the idea is you should get more than 2 years' salary as part of the severance pay. So as you can imagine, this is an issue people are very passionate about because that has huge effects on both sides. So to get an extra 2 years' salary is significant for the one leaving the job, but also for the budget of the yeshiva to pay that much is very significant. So this is a highly controversial topic. And when it gets addressed in Beis Din, as it very, 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 very often does, so the major question is the power of the minig. So essentially, is there a minig that has established that this is the expectation? Or is it not a minig? And if not, why not? What are the terms? So there are entire svarim that are dedicated to this topic. And it's a topic of great significance. And this is essentially the question. It all revolves. This is the main issue in determining whether it goes one way or another or somewhere in between. To what extent is there a minig that declares this should be the case? And there are some schools that will clarify that in advance because this is such a prevalent issue. Say, you have to understand, we're hiring you. We don't provide Chodesh Lashana. We do, we don't. What exactly is the discussion? Because of the question of how to figure out the role of minig in an issue such as that and what qualifies as a minig and what doesn't. And just also to illustrate the role of minig, so there are those who suggest that there is a precedent for severance pay, and maybe specifically then to apply it to something like Chodesh Lashana, because the concept of Hanukkah, that when an Eved was released, so he would be given property. So on the one hand, so just to illustrate the development of Minig and the difference between Minig and Din as formulated, so we understand that the Din of Hanukkah and an Eved is not applicable to a Rebbe leaving a yeshiva. But that's not the point. The point is that, is there a certain value that that displays that can then serve as legitimate basis for a minig? You follow? Right, the idea is that we understand the minig is not explicit in earlier halacha. The question is, does the minig have any connection to an earlier halacha? Can it legitimately be said that it is developing a halachic value? And just to illustrate it in the more ritual area, I wrote an article many years ago. It's published in Tradition, and I wanted to illustrate the role of minig in general. And I used the example of, so it's kedai to talk about before Simchas Torah, there's a minig that if a Sefer Torah falls, Rahman al-Islam, that there should be a fast. And some talk about fasting 40 days. So it's much, much more common in the literature. It's a much briefer fast. But the idea of fasting for a Sefer Torah that falls is extensively discussed in the later literature. But it's not in the Gemara. It's not in Shulchan Aruch either. It's a post-Shulchan Aruch minig. And it's still a very widespread idea that posts can discuss at great length. So some of the poskim, when they talk about this whole concept, so they'll point to Gemara. So, for example, it's the Gemara Moed Katan that says that if a Sefer Torah is burnt, God forbid, so then one should tear Kriya. So others responded to that point, bringing up that Gemara, and they say, well, yeah, but there the Sefer Torah didn't fall, it was destroyed. And Kriya is different than fasting. So it's not a good proof. But the response to that is, no one ever said it was a proof. It's not being quoted in order to prove that there's a din in the Gemara that one should fast for a Sefer Torah that falls. We know there's no din like that in the Gemara. The question is, the minig that has developed to do that, so where does that come from? So the Gemara is quoted to establish that there is a notion that if something happens to a Sefer Torah, there should be a reaction. And then that minig developed along those lines to have a reaction not just when it's destroyed, but even if it falls. And not just of Kriya, but fasting. But the relevance of the Gemara is to show that there is a value there that the minig is developing. So to hear, we talk about the Hanukkah and Chodesh Lashana, so we know it's a different din, but the point is that it's, in order for it to be established as a minig, that's a part of the discussion. Does it correlate to any kind of halachic value? This is also, you could speculate, but just it's also a little bit relevant to this coming year. But there is a major discussion in halacha of contemporary discussion that does the halacha recognize the concept of bankruptcy? And so in secular law, there is an idea that if somebody is deeply in debt and can't pay off the debts, that the courts could declare him bankrupt, which would absolve him from paying off at least the totality of his debts. So it's an important question to establish. Does the halacha recognize that? Because the halacha that requires you to pay back what you borrow and certainly recognizes the validity of debts that a person has to people who have lent him money. So it's very important to know, does the halacha acknowledge this concept? If one goes to court and declares bankruptcy, so does the halacha also agree that he is off the hook for the debts that he incurred? So it's very important to clarify, it's got major nafkaminas. So it's a big discussion. It's not for now. We could talk about it a different time, but it's a big discussion whether or not there's room for halacha to acknowledge something like that that is not in the existing din, but becomes a part of the practice, gets to the question of the role of Dina de Malchus Adina. And that's also, there's a lot of overlap in the literature between Minhag and Mamonos and Dina de Malchus Adina, because what exactly is the scope of Dina de Malchus Adina is an important discussion. So we know that the Talmud tells us that civil law is valid, but for what purposes and to what extent? And very importantly, does it also govern the financial relationship between two Jews? So we have a whole Choshen Mishpat that talks about how Jews are supposed to interact in business. So to what extent does secular law affect that because of Dina Malchus Adina? Hi.
Even if Dina Malchus Adina applied, if the Jew went, wouldn't they not be allowed to go in the first place anyway?
To a court.
Yeah.
Yes, but they can't go to a secular court. That's a separate issue. But the question is, let's say they go to Beis Din. Right? So the two Jews go to Beis Din, and they say, okay, this is what I did because I assume this is what state law requires. And I claim that I am owed this money because of state law. So very often, I don't want to oversimplify a complex discussion, but often Beis Din will recognize that Dina de Malchus Adina governed their relationship. So it's being adjudicated in Beis Din. I can't adjudicate it in court. But the Beis Din will often work off on the premise that Dina de Malchus Adina was guiding how they treated each other. So there is a overlap, there's a tangency between Dina de Malchus Adina and Minhag in the context of Mamonos. Because to the extent that you say that Dina de Malchus Adina is going to decide who's right and who's wrong in a dispute between two Jews, so there's still two ways of understanding that. Could be just because you understand that the law is binding, or the law wouldn't have to be binding necessarily, but the law represents the Minhag. That's what people do in this place. And people in New York State, that's how they interact in business, and everybody who's working in this industry is working under these expectations. And therefore, that's a Minhag. That becomes the practice that everybody expects when they go into business with each other. And that might be a legitimate basis, very likely could be a legitimate basis for a Beis Din to decide how two partners or two otherwise interacting people should decide their disputes. So a question like bankruptcy, so it's very important to know, does the halacha recognize that you are free from paying your debts just because bankruptcy has been declared? And you can imagine there's all kinds of nafkaminas of that. So that's a big discussion. It ties into the question of the impact of Dina de Malchus Adina. But one could suggest, you know, we're looking at a Shemitah year now, so Shemitah includes, at the end, the concept of Shemitas Ksafim, that one is absolved, at least theoretically, from the loans, from paying the loans that they have taken out. There's an amnesty on loans. So one could argue that, without getting into right now whether it's compelling or not, but one could argue theoretically that bankruptcy should be recognized as a minhag because, A, it's the law of the land, but also it's not foreign to Jewish values. We have a concept of Shemitas Ksafim, which is different than bankruptcy. No one's going to say that shows you that bankruptcy is there in the Torah. But the idea that somebody should have some period of amnesty after some point, that there should be some limit to how far in debt a person can go, and that they should ultimately be rescued from that. So one could argue that that does seem to exist in the Torah system, and therefore to say that there's a minhag along those lines might be more credible. So that gets into the question of what do we need in order for something to be a minhag? So when it comes to general law, when it comes to general halacha, so we revere minhagim, but specifically those minhagim that we can understand have some connection to halachic values. And if the minig is not connected to anything, it was just completely circumstantial, so then that's not a minig. And I tell a joke about the Chassidish Rebbe who was about to make Havdalah. There was a broom in the room, so he wanted to move the broom away, but he realized that people watching were going to think there's a minig to bring a broom and to move it before Havdalah. So he made an announcement. He said, this is not a minig, there's just a broom on the table, so I'm moving it away before making Havdalah. So then it came to be that every Motzei Shabbos, Chassidim would say, Havdalah time, this is not a minig, I'm just moving the broom in order to get it away. So if it has no connection to anything, it's just because there was a room on the table, so that doesn't create a minig. So a minig, when it comes to halachic practice, is very, very crucial, but it's not something that is going to be random. It has to be meaningful. It has to be connected to some kind of a din. And when it does, so then it takes on great importance. And this is a part of current reality. You know, we're hoping this year should be better than last year, but last year, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur time, we were very much affected by the COVID situation, and the assumption was that the minyanim would have to be as short as possible on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and there was extensive discussion as to how to accommodate the recitation of piyutim and the like. In the context of the davening. So on the one hand, we know it's not a din d'oraisa, it's not a din d'rabbanan, but the importance of a minig and the way it impacts on how the yontif is observed is not a small thing. It's something that, and it's in that context also, that we find the poskim writing in the context of the piyutim, that the same kind of language we find here about a kol k'minig ha-medina and even a minig v'v'atol halacha, in that context, is always taken very seriously. So the question is, so when it comes to those aspects of practice, so we have tremendous chashivas for minhagim, but minhagim that are connected to some kind of a din, some kind of a halachic practice. Is it the same when it comes to mamonos? So the usage of minig and mamonos, so does that have the same requirement, or are there other factors that are at play? As we've got to see a little bit, there could be other reasons that we look to minig in terms of these dinim. So when it comes to the way workers or employees relate to each other, employers and employees relate to each other, so Gemara emphasizes minig. So is that because there are things that are reflective of certain halachic values, or is it because of something else? Or, for example, another area, I gave you a short siman in Shulchan Aruch to look at this morning. We saw that one of the major impacts of minig in mamonos, one of the many, but one of the major areas, is a concept called situmta. So situmta means that among the many kinyanim that exist, there are many, many different ways that we have in halacha to effect a transfer of property. I don't know how many of you have ever witnessed the mechiras chametz take place. So you'll see that we utilize as many kinyanim as possible. So one of the kinyanim that's used there is a concept called situmta. So what is a situmta? Zach? Well, that could have been a situmta, actually. That could have been a kinyan. Well, that's probably not a situmta per se, but a handshake would be a situmta. That situmta means a kinyan that is the minhag ha-makom. That if there are certain things that are done in a certain culture that signify that a deal is done, so then that becomes a halachically valid kinyan. So we have many, many other ways of kinyanim. And among them is this idea of a situmta, which doesn't have a specific surah in halacha. It takes the tzura of whatever is done in that culture. So if in your culture a handshake is a way of sealing a deal, so then that becomes the kinyan because of the minig. And that cuts both ways, because there the minig is able to create a kinyan that wasn't there before. So it has a positive impact, so to speak, in halacha, creating something new, an affirmative impact, creating something that wasn't there before. And theoretically, it could also have a negative impact, meaning it could restructure things in a way that changed the rules. So it could be that, at least theoretically, a kinyan that could have worked maybe is not going to work because the minig is not to consider a deal done until a certain practice is performed. So if the minig says that you don't have a deal unless you do X, Y, and Z, so then that might change the halacha the other direction. So you could add a kinyan, it could also subtract other kinyanim theoretically because of the impact of minig. That was also affected by COVID, by the way, because the mechiras chametz, this becomes actually that this specifically. So especially 2 mechiras chametz ago, again at the height of COVID, it was a month in, really the height, the first Pesach, that was just a month after the whole thing had started, was the most intense time. So normally mechiras chametz is done with many, many kinyanim, and that first Pesach, so not all the kinyanim were considered safe. So people weren't comfortable shaking hands. So shaking hands is normally done as part of the mechiras chametz, as a situmta, you don't talk about shaking hands in the Gemara, but shaking hands is the minig hamakom to seal the deal. So that's a situmta. So the role of that kinyan in the whole process became a discussion. So if you subtract that from the mechiras chametz, how much of an impact does that have? So if that became the new thing, right? So it poses another interesting question. So how much time does it take for a new minig to be established? And would that replace the handshakes? Interesting question. It's also always the context. So if the context makes it obvious that you're doing it for this reason, how much does that affect things? Right? So it's a very relevant question. So let's say you have a culture where every deal is always done with a handshake. And then COVID hits and people aren't comfortable shaking hands anymore. So does that already explain it? So does that change? Because the minig is affected by this explanation. So that itself becomes an interesting question. So, with all that introduction, and with dwindling time, so it becomes important to clarify, so where do the minhagim come from in terms of their authority? So that's something that we've seen a little bit, and we saw a different stadim associated with different dinim in our Gemara, different scenarios in our Gemara. But overall, if you got a chance to see some of the Rishonim this morning from various places, so you'll see that there are discussions about the general tokef of minhagim in the area of mamonos, and where does it come from? So what are the possibilities that you see in the Rishonim? Yeah, Zach?
I think this was in the Ramban that we read, but it was everybody agreed to it.
Okay, so everybody.
Well, the specific thing is everybody came, like Kobane here came and were, I guess, were making it.
So that was two possibilities. Together. So he mentioned two possibilities.
Or yeah, like 10 people.
Right. So, and those are different from each other. So yeah. One possibility is that it's just what people do. And therefore, it's the implicit understanding. That's the expectation. So people understand that this is how business is carried out. And therefore, that becomes the terms. While the Ramban and others also mention a more formal possibility that, no, maybe it needs more than that. Maybe it needs some kind of formal policy setting. That it has to be more of a takana. It means that societies can create their rules, but the rules have to be formalized. So whatever the governing body is that acts on behalf of the Tzibur, so they can create a policy, and that's a minhag. But without some kind of formal process, according to one opinion, that wouldn't be considered a minhag. A minhag has to have some kind of... So when we say minhag mevatel halacha, or kol k'minhag hamedina, we mean that we are empowering the leadership to create minhagim. But they still would need to do it. They still would need to actually have some kind of process like that. So it's clear from many other views in Rishonim that we don't necessarily need that. That whatever is what's done, that's considered to be a minhag. And that's the understanding that people are working under. So that's what it sounds like from the Rambam. So, for example, we saw one of the Rambams put on the list this morning in Hilchos Mechira. So he talks about the very important issue of Mekach Tos. That's another issue that people can litigate with great ferocity. And so if I buy something and I then decide, or I discover something that makes me assert that it's not what I wanted, it's not what I had in mind, and I come back to the seller and I say, this isn't what I thought I was buying, I want my money back. And the seller says, what, that, the color you wanted, you thought it was blue and it's off blue, that's not different, that's not a significant difference that should justify my having to give you a rebate. So where do you draw the line? What's a significant enough flaw that somebody can declare it's a mekach tos and I want my money back? This happens to be also which the huge issue in halacha, and there are many thick svarim that go through the details of mekach tos and the like. So the Rambam in that halacha says that part of it is the minhag. So what do people perceive as a mum, as a flaw in an item that would justify demanding a rebate, a refund? So that apparently is understood as directed by minhag also. So it sounds like from the way the Rambam expresses it, and also the Rashba, I didn't put the Rashba on this morning, because the Rashba and his tshuvas was already on from day one. If you recall that long tshuva about minhag, so he didn't put it there again, but the same tshuva the Rashba you saw. So they understand it as these are the understandings that people have, that it's ki'ilu hisnu, it's as if they specifically conditioned their deal on these terms, because everyone knows that that's what we mean when we talk about things. And everyone knows that if I buy this product, so it matters if it has this, it doesn't matter if it has that, and what matters and what doesn't matter is determined by common understanding. Okay, so far so good. Everybody with me? So that's already a few understandings of what drives the minhag in Mamonos, whether it is just a common understanding or whether it is a communal policy that's formally established. Or there are some who understand, like the Or Zarua, that it must come specifically from Talmidei Chachamim, which is a more extreme understanding. And that would put it more in line with minhagim in other areas. So when it comes to minhagim in areas of ritual, so there we talk about minhagim that are associated with Talmidei Chachamim. We don't necessarily mean that Talmidei Chachamim had to formally enact them, but we mean that they at least approve of them, and that they recognize them as being meaningful. So the idea that Talmidei Chachamim would have to be associated with minhagim in the area of Mamonos, so that's a bigger chiddush, but it could be. The Chazon Ish, here on our Gemara, in his comments in the beginning of Baba Basra, Chazon Ish understands that when you have people, just as a whole, the whole community has a consensus on something, that they agree that that's the way things are done, that that has the koach of a communal enactment. That that's as if they enacted something the way some of the Rishonim required it, that there should be this more formal enactment. So the Chazon Ish understood that if there is a consensus with everyone that that's how things are done, so the Koach HaTzibur is like the Koach of a Takana. So the existence of people doing that makes it something that has its own significance. Rav Asher Weiss has just there's more to say about. Just mentioned the 2 points, then we'll have to break for Mincha, and maybe we'll figure out how much more to say before moving on. But Rav Asher Weiss has an essay about this, which you can find on his website. I'm not sure if this is any of the printed svarim, but this you can find on the Torah Base website. But he has his understanding is he thinks that really all menhagim come from the same place, and that the ritual menhagim and the menhagim of mamonos, despite all the distinctions that are possible to say that we mentioned, he thinks that the literature indicates that they are interchangeable, and that the phrase hakol k'minig hamedina we find in both contexts, and the phrase minig v'vat halacha we find in both contexts. And therefore, they are all of a kind, and they all stem from the same type of origin of Al Titosh Torah Simecha, which is a very interesting perspective because we have a lot of basis to distinguish between them and to say that Mamonos Menhagim could come from other kind of sources. Presumably, to make them all in one category, we have to say that the common foundation is that we recognize the authority of the people, that we assume there is a intuited value system until proven otherwise, which sometimes could be, but the default is that there is an intuited value system, and that when enough of a proportion of the people do something, both in terms of the number of people who do it and the seriousness of people who do it and the pervasiveness of a certain practice, when it reaches a certain threshold, however you calculate that, that it means that there's meaning there, and that the principle that is tying all these different things together is saying that we should respect that meaningfulness, that we should respect that in the area of ritual when we say certain piyutim on Yom Kippur, we have a reaction to a Sefer Torah falling or whatever it is, that that represents a certain chachma that's coming at us from a different direction. This chachma that comes from Sinai, and this chachma that comes from the Talmidei Chachamim who interpret the Torah, and this chachma that comes from the people who live the Torah, and all of those are paths of chachma that we should revere. So then, just like that's true in Hilchos Tefillah Yom Kippur, or in Hilchos, any other area of life, it's also true in our monetary interactions that we should assume that whatever is being done in this culture, till proven otherwise, is reflective of a worked out system and reflective of how people want to treat each other and how they want to be treated, and therefore it has an inherent validity, and it's something that should impact how we make our decisions. Hi.
That final argument sort of sounds like a natural law argument to me.
A little bit, except it's coming in a softer sense. That I think natural law has a lot of different elements to it. But natural law is assuming that morality can be determined based on what people think is right. And then it opens up all kinds of questions of whether that's true and whether that should contradict other sources of morality. So here I think it's coming much softer. It's not saying that this is the whole source of morality, and it's not saying that it's absolutely binding. It's saying that there's a value to what people do, and that it should be taken seriously. And that when practice is developed, they probably develop because they have been tested or because they represent what is best for societal harmony and societal fairness, and therefore that should be the default. Could be disproven by other things, and it could be outweighed by other things, but the default that when all else is equal, that there is something to be said for what people do, that could be the common basis in Minig in all these different areas. So just to restate this last sentence before we go to Mincha, but basically what point being made here is that there's a lot of room to distinguish between Minhagim and Mamonos and Minhagim in other areas of Halacha, and a lot of reasons to say that we should follow a Minig that don't come from this particular perspective, but to whatever extent they are connected, to whatever extent we should assume they're all a part of one sentence, perhaps that is the common foundation between them. That in all areas of life, there's a default to what has developed among the practice of people. It's not 100% ironclad. It's not going to win out over other disputable Torah commandments or things like that, but that there is a default to prefer that which is a part of the general practice and tested through time, through interactions, such as going to Menachon time. So I guess we'll stop here. Tomorrow, again, a lot to do in the Parsha, and we'll see what else we can fit in, and be in a more normal schedule, and hopefully we should have a more comfortable temperature. Well,